Members, we're going to go ahead, given that we have a lot on the schedule. And we have the fine representative here to talk about his bill. So if you wanted to, Representative David's, you don't need to make the motion either?
No,
okay, sorry. We're just going to, if you can give us the outline and the details here of 3249, then we can pass it as folks come in and make our quorum.
Okay. So. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. House File 3249 basically amends current law, the move-over law. We're changing it somewhat, whereas under the current move-over law, if you have a four-lane highway, two lanes on each side, and you see an emergency vehicle generally on the right side, wouldn't have to be, but generally the right side, you get, well whether it's right or left, it doesn't matter, you get over to the other lane. That's a very important law that we passed some years ago. It's I would say that it has saved lives. Now, this bill takes it one step further. It goes from basically from four lanes to two lanes. So where you have an emergency vehicle or a utility vehicle on the side of the road, if you can't get to the other lane, you have to be careful because we can't make people go in the other lane if there's oncoming traffic, obviously. It just says, as you'll notice on page 3, that we need to slow like way down, either slow down or stop, and so that's it's a very simple bill, but I think it's a very important bill, and it's a very important bill for the safety of these workers. Madam Chair, I have with me today a Mr. Kellen Schmidt, who has been working on this with he's an employee of XL Energy, and I have Peter Lindahl from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local Union 292. So with that, if we go to the testimony from Mr. Schmidt, please.
So, and Representative Davids, we do have a quorum now. So I'm going to officially call the meeting of the Transportation Policy and Regional Governance Committee to order. And I wonder if someone would give us a motion on the minutes from the meeting of March 13th.
So moved.
Representative Kosnick moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. All right. So, welcome, Representative Davids, and we'll make the motion that House File 3249 come before the committee and be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. So, welcome, and we'll go ahead with your testimony.
And thank you. Thank you, members, and if we could start off with Mr. Kellen Schmidt.
All right. Welcome, Mr. Schmidt.
Hi, Chair, Representatives. My name is Kellen Schmidt. I am a lineman for XL Energy. I live out in Belle Plaine, Minnesota, which is just north of Belle Plaine, which is in Carver County. I'm a lineman, like I said. I work alongside the roadways every day. As you all know, traffic is just crazy out there. One thing that we run into on a daily basis is traffic flying past our work zones. We have stories upon stories in our safety meetings of our road cones getting knocked over. Our hard hats getting blown off our heads. It's just a matter of time before one of the utility workers out there throughout the state gets killed on the roadway. It's happened years ago with companies down by Lakeville, and it's going to happen again. These co-workers, they're family to me. They're family to the Brotherhood Electrical Workers, and I feel like we need to get a change going. Somebody's going to die. Electricity used to be the number one hazard in my occupation. Today, I think it's traffic.
Mr. Kellen, or Mr. Schmidt, I'm sorry, Mr. Schmidt. So is it that we're working closer to the shoulder? Or, I mean, I noticed, too, the trucks and the workers are very near the shoulder. And why is that? And it's, you know, it's frequent, so...
Chair Runbeck, we try to get off the shoulder as much as we can. We have bucket trucks, we have outrigger pads that come down, and a lot of times you can only get so far off the shoulder. For instance, if you have a wet spring, these outrigger pads dig into the soil. So as you're working sideways off the truck, there's a good chance for these trucks to tip over. So with appropriate signage and conage, we try to stay off the shoulder as much as we can. But sometimes, you know, we're limited.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. And now we have Mr. Peter Lindahl. Welcome, sir, and please give us your name and who you represent for the record.
Chair Rumbeck, Representative Peter Lindahl.
Thank you. I'll try to keep this as short as possible. My name is Peter Lindahl. I'm from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. I'm the business manager in that organization. We represent hundreds of workers that across the state that work on highway projects. I'm here today to speak in favor of this improved bill. I worked for several years for a contractor that did highway work, and I saw that every day. As Kellen explained, traffic is right next to us, and one move that's not a driver not paying attention can be the difference of life and death. Barriers can't always be set up on these roads, and I do applaud the proactive approach to this committee and the author of this bill to help the workers out there. 26 years ago, give me a second, please. I lost my mom in an uncontrolled intersection. The neighborhood, it was South Minneapolis. I don't know if anybody lives there, but we begged for stop signs. And it took, I guess, a death to get that taken care of. more recently, two of my members on 35, I think Kelm mentioned that, lost their life on 35 down in Burnsville.
Right, we've heard that testimony, yes, in the committee before.
You know, they both had young families. One of them was a friend. Again, I just want to thank you for taking this proactive approach. And we have members that are relying on you to help protect them the best that we can. We'd like to keep the roads flowing, safe, and up to date, but that takes the workers right there to do that. So thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, Chair Rumbeck, representatives. Thank you.
For your testimony, Mr. Lindahl. And can I just ask, so are you able, when you've got a crew out there, are you able to notify law enforcement? Because I see they can issue citations. I mean, are they able to sort of go, oh, we'll stop by, maybe we're going to catch somebody who's violating this law? I mean, would they respond and help you that way by just being present more often and looking for the violators?
I think any time,
Mr. Lindahl,
Chair Representatives, I think any time that law enforcement can be present is always an asset to protecting the workers. I think that law enforcement would probably tell you the same thing. They have troubles when they pull people over that they're not respecting that space. Anything that can be done to protect those workers would be greatly appreciated. I don't know, other than the roads having wider shoulders and things of that sort. Real estate, I'm sure, is very, very pricey to have that. And from my experiences on the road, we had plenty of space, but those cars, they just seem to need to get to where they're going as fast as possible. It's all about the traffic and getting to where they're going.
Representative Hirschhaus.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Davids, and testifiers for this bill. One thing came to just a thought while I was listening to you is recently we passed some legislation to allow motorists to cross a yellow line to get out of the way for bicycles. And I reside in a rural part of Hennepin County where we have a lot of county roads winding and undulating when oftentimes a crew might be working in the right-of-way or in circumstance that you've described, but it's double yellow. And I'm just wondering if you thought about, or maybe in the next stop, adding some language that would make it permissible to cross that yellow, especially when safety dictates that there's no oncoming vehicle or something like that.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Hirschhaus's comments, I think that's very helpful. I think I was trying to, and maybe research could help here a little bit, because do we address in this bill the concerns of Representative Hirschhaus? Because you need to slow down, but what if you can't get in the other lane? So it says you can get in the other lane if you need to, if it's safe. Maybe, Mr. Burst, does the language of the bill address the comments of Representative Hertas? Because I know you're supposed to slow down and stop if you can't get in the other lane, but how can you get in the other lane?
Right. I think then the issue is the yellow line, really, I think.
Yes.
So, Representative or Mr. Burris?
Madam Chair and members, the language of the bill only addresses slowing down and doesn't get into moving into other lanes. There are a couple of other provisions in law and in another section or two of statutes in the traffic regulations that address a variety of scenarios involving getting into other lanes. I need to take a look through that language, but it would probably involve a conforming change or an additional change from what's in the bill currently.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm certainly open to that.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Hertas, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that probably most everybody would admit that when you're driving on the road or your rural area or whatever, you know, some of your wheels have crossed the yellow line. And I don't always look if maybe a squad car is parked and hiding over on the shoulders, seeing if anybody's there or doing enforcement actions, I'm told. But that would be something that I would support, permissiveness, as long as it's not putting anybody in jeopardy to be able to swing out of the way and give you guys more room.
Thank you.
So,
sure.
Representative Davids, it sounds like there might be some opportunity to discuss this on its way to the Public Safety Committee then?
Absolutely.
Okay, very good.
Madam Chair.
All right, is there anyone from the audience who wishes to testify before or for or against? Okay, seeing none, then, I will renew my motion that House File 3249 be referred to the Public Safety Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
He had something to say here.
Oh, Representative, we may have just a postscript here from Mr. Burris. You want to?
Madam Chair and members, I was just starting to take a look at some of the other driving rules and did notice that there are references to both of the move-over law provisions. So passing the parked emergency vehicles as well as various other types of road maintenance type vehicles. So there's a provision on keeping to the right half of the roadway, and it lays out some exceptions that includes to comply with the move over or to in order to move over. So I'd want to study it a little bit more, but an initial look, it looks like Representative Hertas's concerns might already be addressed in statute.
Okay, very good.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We will follow up on that.
All righty. Thank you very much, Representative Davids. Next up is Representative Miller, House File 3261.
Thank you, Madam
Welcome,
Chair.
Welcome, Representative.
And, thank you. I have to plug in my computer real quick and grab a chair.
All right. While you're doing that, I'll make a motion that House File 3261 come before the committee and be re-referred to the General Register. Oops. Okay. I'm going to remake that motion. Yeah.
Get these out of here. I'm going to eat them.
Okay. So, Representative, slightly new and redirected motion here. So, we'll make that motion.
Right.
House File 3261 will be re-referred to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. You are in for a treat this morning. Not exactly the treat that you see when he starts handing bottles of wine out. You don't get to have those. But I just lost my page. You go ahead and handle those out now. Just something for you to look at. We have, in rural Minnesota, we've been blessed with a growing industry over recent years that's really supportive of not only agriculture, but agritourism is something that's very important to us. And it's also about bringing young people back into agriculture, which for me, these are young people. You may not think of yourself as that young, but they are definitely younger people. When you think that the average farmer's age is 57 years old, they're definitely younger than 57 years old, as is all of you in this room, I'm sure. So, however, as this business grows, as you might imagine, there are some particulars that kind of come up that we need to make some changes.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have...
We're passing the wine around, so no one's listening to me.
To be distracted. Okay, it's a bottle of wine.
Go ahead and put some more. So anyway, I'll explain those in a little bit. Joe, yeah, we let the Irishman hold a bottle of wine. That's great. It's not whiskey, right? So sorry, Madam Chair. Trying to get back on path. So, but anyway, as these businesses grow, we've run into a unique situation when it comes to advertising where these are at, because a lot of these vineyards and these wineries are on the farm, as you might imagine, which puts them on off the beaten path. And so we're running into a little bit of a no man's land with signage. We're running into no man's land with signage, and over the past about year and a half or 2 years now, myself and the Coonans here have been trying to find a pathway to which we can address their signage needs, which we'll discuss here very shortly. But we brought forward legislation that I believe is narrow enough that we don't open up a whole new bottle of wine, but can address these needs. So what I'd like to do first is the Coonans, who you will... What did I do wrong now?
No, I did that.
Okay, there we go. I'm just going to play a brief video the Postcards did of their business, and then I'm going to let them speak. And this is going to be about a 3.5-minute video.
Sounds great.
The sound's not happening, of course. Sorry, Madam Chair, I was told this would all work.
We're on to slide two. We don't want to make this two in a row. We've misfired with our AV here.
Hold on a second. Let me know if you can hear it with the microphone, because I'm not even seeing where. Oh. It's really irritating.
I hear
You're
something.
You're not hearing it, are you?
I'm hearing a little. There we go. It's getting better.
Coonan Vineyards is basically a kind of local, more social establishment that's been created out here in the last 5 years. Our point was to give people some place to go that wasn't a chain restaurant, that wasn't a local bar, different atmosphere all in general. And we've done that by creating our own wines, doing kind of our own food menu, and also bringing in local entertainment, which has kind of disappeared in these regions in the last decade.
That's better.
Mm-hmm. Being located in a rural community, it's its own little niche thing. We found that we've had to not look at what the normal research says. Being in, say, a big town like Minneapolis, you can do...
That's what I get for trying to multitask here. Sorry, Chair. Very
a lot of variety things, but you're going to have to do it to a mass market, whereas around here, we have to go according to what people around here want, not just what we want.
The visuals are great.
Other wineries in the state of Minnesota, we are on a working farm in a rural community. We're adjacent to the vineyard. A lot of wineries, you don't see that. You're either not allowed to go out by it, or you really don't see how they function together in one entity the way they do out here. The bulk of what we do out here is grown here, is processed here, is bottled here. The furthest the bottle of wine travels out here when you drink it is maybe a quarter of a mile. You know, the furthest vine is a quarter of a mile that direction.
So we first started doing the winery just the tasting room. We expected it to be some great thing that everybody was going to come out and see, and definitely we needed to add more. So we ended up starting with a food trailer. We started really just with some flatbread pizzas, and that evolved into having a full menu and learning, oh, there's a reason why chain restaurants have an evolving menu every so many weeks. You need people to constantly see their change.
Now we took it all away. Just keep it going. We're almost done.
We're kind of lucky where we're at. We live very close to local pork production, local beef production, local bison production. So we do a lot of actual bison products out here. Things that you wouldn't see on a normal menu, but they're not out of people's comfort zone. That's kind of the trick, is take a food that's common and make it just uncomfortable enough and then scale it back a little bit.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm going to go and stop the video right there. What I really wanted to do is just express to you what this business was about and what we do. You will see many of the vineyards that are very similar like this across greater Minnesota. So at this time, Madam Chair, I would like to have my testifiers who own this business tell you a little bit about themselves and what their needs are when it comes to signage.
Very good, Representative. Who's going to start, please?
I'll start. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Eric Coonan, my wife, Afton. The winery and vineyard was actually started in 2005 as more of a family project. My father farms full-time out in western Minnesota, and as we've grown, obviously a lot's going on out there at once. So we purchased the business in 2013, 15, somewhere in there. It was a lengthy process. And one of our biggest problems is when we have people traveling there from a greater distance, it's because I'm right not on the main highway, it's how do I get them there? And unfortunately, we kind of slip through the cracks of the signage process.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, for having us here.
Please give us your name for the record, please.
My name is Afton Coonan. I'm co-owner with my husband for the winery. Our biggest problem for the winery is the signage. We're a quarter mile off of the main highway, which makes it harder for people to find. Most people coming from the cities don't really know what a gravel road is, let alone that they should go down that road. We just have one small directional sign that people can see, and a lot of times that has to get taken away due to snow and snowmobilers in our area. So a lot of the time in the winter, you don't even have a sign to point them in our direction. So to have the blue signs would be fantastic for us because it's always going to be there and people are always seeing it, knowing exactly where to find us.
Madam Chair, if I could add.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So what we've been looking at for the past year and a half, I take legislation very seriously, and we don't just legislate away every single problem where that's always be dealing. So about a year and a half ago, Eric came to me and had said, I have this problem. I can't put my own private sign because of these rules, and I can't put the blue sign up because of these rules, which, by the way, there is a fiscal note on this, and that's why it's going to go to Ways and Means. But the owners have to pay for these signs, so there's no cost to the state whatsoever. We went the route. The first thing it says, well, let's see what the law says. And in part of the law, there, and I went with research. Research did a great job, and they said, well, you need to go through this appeals process. And he said I had already done that because they're falling through the cracks. That's why I have appeals process. There's this committee that forms and says, well, here's an exception. And they were refused the first time. I said, well, please go through that again. So they went through that process, which takes some time and takes time out of their own lives and their business to be able to do this. And I have no issue with MnDOT saying they still don't qualify according to the rules. I'm fine with that. But then we needed to do something. So then I went to research here, talked to my local MnDOT people, talked to different people, and said, what can we craft that addresses this growing need? We have more farm wineries that are growing. It's in statute as an actual thing. Farm wineries is in statute. That's why it's in this bill here today. What can we do to address this need where people are not normally accustomed to where they're going out in rural Minnesota, yet they can identify where these places are? So we crafted the bill as you see it here today. We think it's a fair approach forward, and I look forward to your support for it.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions? Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that you're running into roadblocks putting up your own signage as well. Is that due to local zoning ordinances, or what problems are you running into there?
We are located right off of State
Coonan.
Highway. We're located right off of State Highway 23. Mm-hmm. We're just half a mile down a gravel road. And correct me if I'm wrong, we're not allowed to do off-premise advertising in Minnesota. And that's what we ran into, is they're calling that an off-premise advertisement.
That's all right. Representative New.
That's a good question. Is that true that that's state law that you can't do? I mean, I know that when I was on the local planning commission and zoning commission, we changed the local ordinance to allow for significant more signage. So I'm just wondering if that's, is that based on state law?
Mr. Burris, can you shed some light?
Madam Chair, Representative New, it's a combination of state and federal law. So there's a chapter of statutes that lays out the prohibition on advertising and then various exceptions and conditions around that. That chapter actually works in conjunction with federal law requirements around federal aid highways and limitations under federal law on advertising.
Great. Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, question for the testifier and or Representative Miller. Highway 23, I know that there's a coalition from Wilmer and Clara City and Spicer that are wanting to, I think, make that four-lane or enhance that. Does that affect the would that affect the sign if this is goes into law, or how does that affect this at all? If
Madam Chair, I can answer that. The Highway 23 Coalition has a north branch and a south branch. This is kind of in between the two. So where we're talking about here, it would not be affected. They're not going to expand the lanes at that time. We have just north of it a passing lane. The improvements made on 23 here were a couple of years ago. Although these are, to understand, this is we're just requesting, there's existing rules for what qualifies for a blue sign, I'll call it. That's what we call them right now. But it's based off of number of days in business, number of days of operation. And as you grow retail, so the nature of their business, they're working 24/7 like all farmers do, okay? But their place of that you saw here where they have the music and they have the wine tastings and they have the meals and things like that, and stay tuned, Representative McDonald. I will be having an event out there this summer, so I look forward to you come joining us so you can see it firsthand. But anyway, that's only basically open on weekends or for very rare special occasions. So they fall outside of the rules of MnDOT of having one of those blue signs. But you'd see a blue sign even on a four-lane highway.
So, Representative Miller, we do have Mr. Rudin from MnDOT, and I believe he does want to testify, and he might be able to clarify some things. Yeah. Welcome, Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs. And, you know, we appreciate the fact that this business would like a sign and that they've gone through the process to try to get a sign, but unfortunately they don't qualify. And so just a little bit of background. The blue signs that are out there are established. The program is established in statute, and it's for gas, food, lodging, places of worship, rural agricultural businesses, and tourist-oriented businesses. And so a winery does qualify today if it meets the criteria that are laid out. And there are over 1,100 businesses that already qualify for this program. So the concern that the department has about this bill is that it would direct motorists to a business potentially up to 15 miles off of the trunk highway that may not be open. The bill requires a business to only be open for 4 hours a day, 2 days a week. So that's a pretty limited hour of operation. And we just think that the public would expect that a business that they're traveling to would be open, more than four hours a day, 2 days a week. So another concern that we have is that if we make this change for this business, it might open the door to other types of businesses trying to expand the eligibility requirements and just the proliferation of signs out on the highways is always a concern as well. You don't want to have too many signs, and there are, maybe not in this location, but there are other places in the state where there's a proliferation of signs and it can be confusing to motorists. It's also one more obstacle for a vehicle to hit if they go off the road, and so that's a concern as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Mr. Rudin, you said it could be the blue, up to 15 miles away, and what did you mean by that?
The business can be located up to 15 miles from the trunk highway and still be eligible for a sign if they meet the other criteria. Okay. So it can be quite a distance that, you know,
so you're saying other businesses, if this becomes, it goes into law, there could be businesses that are that far off the road. President Miller?
Madam Chair, under.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rudin.
Okay. We can just grab another chair if you want. Madam Chair, that would, remember that this bill defines out farm wineries. So any farm winery that's up to 15 miles away could have one of these signs. And I would argue that this concern, although very valid about driving to an establishment that's not open, that would be the concern of the business owner. I don't see that as it should be problematic for MnDOT.
Okay. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question. On the sign, is there enough room to say that it's only operating 2 days a week? I mean, I know last fall I took a trip down Mississippi, and I can't remember whether the winery was in Minnesota or Wisconsin. But it took us a while. You know, there weren't a whole lot of signs, and we were just about ready to give up when we finally found the winery. But I know there were signs every once in a while, so we eventually did get to it. But it was 2 days a week is not a lot.
Mr. Radin.
Madam Chair and Representative Mason, no, there would not be room on these signs. These are fairly small signs that just have the name of the business and an arrow, and I think we would be concerned if you tried to put the hours of operation on there as well. It would be too much information for somebody who's driving, you know, 55 or 60 miles an hour to try to take in.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Miller.
Madam Chair and Representative Mason, one of the things that I preface this with, is that this is kind of as businesses have grow and things change over time. So one of the things that's also changed is, by all means, these signs are only intended to say Hinterland Vineyard this way. But the customers that they're seeing aren't looking for signs of operation. They have the internet, which they go to for business hours. They have the internet, and also understand that these vineyards tend to be destination places. They also are presumed to be open kind of on weekends. There are exceptions to it, but those are usually very easily seen. Like there's one outside Hutchinson that's open all the time, but they're right on the highway. There's not a problem. This is just trying to address when people are going out driving, and I almost wish I would have brought a map out, but I thought it would be more fun to have wines and videos and see this. But the angle at which Highway 23 goes, and specific for them, the angle of the township road, it's very easy to shoot past, basically, even if you know what you're looking for. And so this would also probably cut down on people slamming on their brakes, doing U-turns and stuff like that. This is just intended to give an indicator. And in regard to the proliferation of signs, there's not a lot of vineyards. And if he says, well, what about other businesses? Well, I welcome the other businesses in greater Minnesota because agritourism is one of the big things that we look forward to. So if there's an antique shop or if there's something else, a cottage industry that's off the road, we certainly want to be able to send people to that. Also understand this is not like the suburbs or the cities where you have a business on every corner or three on every street. You will have the proliferation is you might see an increase of a sign. Instead of seeing one of these signs every 10 miles, you might see a sign every 8 miles or something like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak, provide some testimony? Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to move this. I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3261 to Transportation Finance. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Miller.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is House File 3056, Representative Keel. you could forget to leave one or two. How about that? I lost my thingy here.
Every time you hear something about more money, that's good.
Yeah.
I like
it. Okay, Representative Keel, welcome. And I'll make the motion that House File 3056 come before the committee and be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. So please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3056 amends the disability parking statute, which I believe you have a copy of, that goes back to 1965. It addresses accommodations for individuals with disabilities and created public policy relating to the disability parking certificates. Under current law, those who can certify that a person is physically disabled person for the purposes of statute include licensed physicians assistants, advanced practice registered nurses, and licensed chiropractors. When I was contacted by my constituent, Stephanie, about adding licensed physical therapists to the list, I think, as I reflect on that, it could have quite an impact and a benefit for our citizens. I found out that this bill is an accumulation of 2 years of work with the Minnesota Council of Disabilities and more recently with the Department of Public Safety, who issues the certificates. I believe they're both here today. When I heard my constituent stories, I had to think about how many others across the state of Minnesota are spending money, losing time from work, and waiting unnecessarily. So, the bill for three reasons would be to reduce the health care costs, not requiring an additional and unnecessary visits to a physician to seek a certificate, reducing transportation challenges and costs, especially in rural areas, and eliminating the delay of issuing a permit. So with that, I have Weinrock, right? Why rock
when you can roll?
There you go. I have a heck of a time. I've known Stephanie for quite some time, but some reason that's a mouthful.
So, Representative, it's great to have your constituent here, and we'll hear her testimony. Please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Stephanie Wyrock, and I am a doctor of physical therapy at Rehab Authority. And that is a private practice outpatient clinic located in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. Because my practice is located in a rural area, I provide physical therapy services to a variety of populations, including orthopedics, neurology, geriatrics, pediatrics. I see a large gamut, so I'm a general practitioner in physical therapy. As a healthcare provider and a patient advocate, here's what I'm experiencing. And I'm going to tell you two stories today of Representative Keel's constituents and potentially some experiences maybe your constituents are having. Chelsea is a 24-year-old inventory specialist who is still dealing with the effects of a motor vehicle accident that occurred to her 2 years ago. She recently had a surgery to repair damage to her knee, leaving her on crutches, walking on one leg, and in a brace. Her workplace parking lot is very large and fills very quickly, and this requires her to walk up to 20 minutes from her car to her desk. This had become very taxing and painful for Chelsea, so she contacted her surgeon about this problem, but because of his busy practice, she had to wait 6 weeks to see him in order to get a disability parking permit. Bernice is an 80-year-old grandmother of 10 who was progressing well in physical therapy but had difficulty walking after she broke her ankle. Bernice told me that walking around the grocery store for even 15 minutes was painful and exhausting. I suggested that she go to her doctor and ask about getting a disability parking certificate while she continued to recover from her injury and continue with physical therapy. This is what she told me. My doctor, I can't afford to pay for another tank of gas, drive an extra 60 miles, and pay for another office visit to get a permit from my doctor. I'm already coming here to see you a few days a week, and you actually know my abilities. Can't you just give me one of those? The addition of physical therapists to the statute would allow for improved access to the service for patients like Bernice, who live in rural areas like Thief River Falls, where other qualified healthcare professionals are scarce. Additionally, incorporation of physical therapists to the statute could introduce significant cost savings for individuals with disabilities by preventing otherwise unnecessary physician visits. Unfortunately, I had to tell Bernice that I wasn't on the list, and that the only way that she could get one of these parking permits was to see her physician. As a physical therapist, I regularly track my patients' abilities and disabilities. We utilize standardized tools that accurately measure people's endurance, fall risk, and walking quality and safety. Typically, these tests can take up to 10 minutes to implement, and due to the restraints that physicians, physician assistant, nurse practitioners have, they typically don't administer these tests because they don't have time. Physical therapists may see their patients multiple times a month and can more accurately track their progress or lack of progress. Physical therapists are doctorate-trained, licensed health professionals who are experts in movement and mobility. We evaluate and treat individuals with disabilities and comorbid health conditions. And to become a physical therapist, individuals must go obtain a four-year bachelor degree and a three-year doctorate degree from an accredited public or private institution. And mobility is what we do well. We document data points through treatment of our patients, and we are expert predictors of the course of a disability. And in fact, the data that we collect are used by other healthcare practitioners to distribute these parking passes. So sometimes physicians end up being the middleman. This bill will authorize physical therapists to take care of the certification for your constituents and others here in Minnesota so that they don't have to waste time and money getting what they need. So I came here today, Madam Chairman, from Thief River Falls to ask you to vote in favor of HF 3056. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Can I just ask, is there a concern about too many being out there compared to the number of parking slots? And would there be an instance where you would have someone who needed one for, who needed the long-term six-year certificate, for example? I mean, the six-month, the short-term certificate might be something that you would use how often? 90% of the time or?
Yes, yeah, so thank you, Madam Chairman, for that question. I can't necessarily speak for the Department of Public Safety as to how they would utilize these disability parking permits or how often they would distribute them, but I can say that as a physical therapist, we have a lot of patients that come in both with long-term and short-term disabilities that would benefit from these parking permits that are not able to access them, especially in areas like Thief River Falls and other rural areas where they have to drive sometimes over an hour or 2 hours away to another hospital in order to see their physician, and that usually takes an all-day process. So I can't speak to what the department would say to that, but as a physical therapist, I can speak to the fact that we do have patients that have both long-term and short-term disabilities that come to see us.
Okay. Is Representative Mason?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. In order to take physical therapy, does somebody first need to see a doctor to get the recommendation to see you?
Ms. Wyrock.
So that is a great question. It depends on the insurance that the patient has. If we're talking about Medicare patients, typically, yes, you need to have a doctor's referral to come and see us. But there is limited direct access in the state where patients can come see a physical therapist for up to 90 days without a physician referral. So if you have Blue Cross Blue Shield, you do have access to a physical therapist without a physician's referral.
Thank you. Okay.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill? Well, okay. Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just a question. I think it seems to be a pretty practical and prudent idea. Concern was shared by the chairwoman as well that would there be a concern from your industry and the professional industry or MnDOT that there'd be too many out there? And maybe not. I mean, of course, I'm glad my mother has one because she got it. She would have liked to have gotten one from her physical therapist as well, but it would have been quicker. But is that a thought or concern? And if not, so be it.
So I can't, Ms. Wyrock. Sorry, Madam Chairwoman. I can't necessarily speak for what the DOT would say on that. But as physical therapists, we are trained to see these, and we do measure them. We have standardized tools that, by research, are backed to be sensitive and specific, which means able to rule in or rule out the diagnosis of limited walking ability or having difficulty with mobility and having a disability. So based on our measures that we use, they are able to rule in whether a patient needs these. And as a physical therapist, I'm not going to be having a candy store of disability parking permits at my office. I'm going to give them to the people that would specifically need them. So as far as professionals go, speaking from the professionalistic standpoint, we can measure this very, very well. And based on those measurements, that is the data that MnDOT could use to define whether or not these are being handed out appropriately. But I can't speak for what the department, the Minnesota Department of Transportation, thinks about that at this time.
Okay. Is there anyone from DPS who would have a comment to make? Great. Sounds like we just need a little clarification, so. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please give us your name and who you represent, please.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Thomas DeVita. I am the Program Director for Support Services at Driver and Vehicle Services, the Department of Public Safety. Joined with me is...
Madam Chair, Representatives, I'm Tom Evans. I'm the supervisor for the Special Plate and Plate Impound Departments, which oversees the issuance of the disability parking certificates.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
So I believe the statute was modified back in 2003 to add licensed physician assistants, advanced practice registered nurse, and licensed chiropractor. At that time, we noticed, actually, there was no noticeable change in the amount of certificates that were distributed when we added those categories. It just became a different signing authority. We anticipate that with this addition that there would be no additional change in volume, but we have no data to support any measurements just using the past history from what we saw in 2003.
Okay. Anything else then? Okay. Well, thanks for being here. Thanks for clarifying. And seeing no further questions, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 2921 to the General Register. I'm sorry, House File 3056, excuse me. We're going to send that to HHS Reform. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative, and you're actually up again. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
House File 2921, and I will move that bill. This one is the one that will refer to the General Register, Representative.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Okay. So, please go ahead and describe your bill for us.
Get myself organized here. Madam Chair, members, House File 2921 was also brought to me by a constituent. I have with me Mr. Tom Steinbrenner that works on the rail system and was a little concerned about some safety issues, and I am going to let him explain to you what he would like to do.
Okay, very good. Welcome, Mr. Steinbrenner. Please give us your name and who you represent, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tom Steinbrenner, and I am here on behalf of the Brotherhood of Maintenance Away Employees Division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. I have been working with the Representative Deborah Keel to get language added to Minnesota Statute 169.26, Special Stops at Railroad Crossings, to include other on-track equipment into the current law. By amending the definition of railroad train to include other on-track equipment, or other rolling stock operated upon the rails, whether self-propelled or coupled, we can provide the same protections for on-track equipment that trains currently have in regards to motorist responsibilities at road grade crossings. One of the biggest issues for the need for the amended definition is on-track equipment has evolved into train-like size. They present the same dangers of a train in regards to their relative brake to stop distance. In addition, not every piece of equipment on the track activates signal crossing gates where crossing gates are in use. Basically, without the added language to include on-track equipment, we are telling the general public that if gates are up and they see other on-track equipment approaching, that it poses no risk and it is safe to proceed. This could not be further from the truth. With the additional work attachments such as plows, ballast wings, ditching wings, and booms, we have the same potential for motorist injury as a train in the event of a road grade crossing incident. The proposed added language does not eliminate or supersede railroad right-of-way and on-track operating rules, rather to make the public aware that it is not only railroad trains that travel on the tracks, but other on-track equipment that occupies and travels on them as well. The fix is easy and is supported by rail labor, the railroads themselves, and rail contractors. Similar laws have been passed in California, Louisiana, Illinois, Iowa, Massachusetts, Maryland, Mississippi, Montana, Oregon, Tennessee, Virginia, Wisconsin, Washington, Wyoming, and most recently South Dakota. By adding on-track equipment to the statute, we can provide a greater level of safety at grade crossings for both motorists and operators. of on-track equipment. Thank you.
Mr. Steinbrenner, this is going to take effect when the stock is actually rolling, when it's moving, right?
Yes.
I mean, obviously there's many times when it's stationary,
yes.
I think.
Okay. Yeah, our on-track equipment is stationary at times.
Okay.
But when it's moving, we need the same protections the train has.
Is there any need for signage? I'm just wondering if people, how will they know that this is going to be a new requirement that they stop?
There's already, every crossing already has what we call cross bucks, the X signs you see on, that say railroad. And, under the current statute, when you see an approaching train just with a cross buck alone, you do have to yield to it.
Okay.
Whereas on-track equipment is not protected under that law.
So you mentioned some bucket kind of, I mean, how this is large, sort of hard to stop kind of equipment. I mean, just maybe explain a bit more about the type of equipment it is.
Well, there's several different examples. We do have large, they're called on-track tamping operators. They surface the rail track. And they are hard to, they do have some blind spots just like a train does. And when you're traveling them, it can be hard to, you know, we still approach our crossings with care and with ease because we know we don't have the right of way right now. But there is times where, and then you cannot account for rail conditions. A wet rail or oily rail or a icy rail looks just the same as a normal rail. And it's hard to account for those conditions as well.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak for or against? No, doesn't look like it. So, all right. Moving quickly here. So, House File 2921, I'll re-renew the motion to send that to the General Register. And all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Okay, so, yes, next up would be Representative Drazkowski, Representative Zerwas. Sure, why don't we, we'll go ahead then with Representative Zerwas's House File 3356. Welcome, Representative Zerwas. Let's see. So I will go ahead and move your bill, make a motion that it be re-referred to the General Register. Is that what you had expected?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a DE-1 amendment as well.
Okay. And the DE-1, is that, that being distributed? No, do we not have that?
You did not get amendments submitted to you? Well.
Okay.
Well, all right. That gives us more work to do.
Okay. Do you want to, I mean, there's another, well, no, it's not. There wasn't going to be another stop, so.
No.
Perhaps.
No. We'll end up doing it on the floor, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right, very good. Then we'll go ahead with those plans,
right.
And if you want to tell us how the bill is going to work, then, Mr. and Representative
right.
Ross.
Yep, Madam Chair, members, House File 3356 ends driver's license suspensions for unpaid traffic tickets. There's really broad consensus around the need to limit driver's license suspensions for violations that involve dangerous driving. Organizations as politically diverse as ALEC, the National Center for State Courts, and the Southern Poverty Law Center have documented the enormous economic and fiscal impacts of suspending driver's licenses for unpaid court debt. The ALEC resolution on this issue is in your folder to limit driver's license suspensions to violations that involve dangerous driving. The bills you'll hear today are the product of broad stakeholder agreement, including prosecutors, defense attorneys, right-on-crime organizations, faith-based groups, and community organizations. What the bill does, the bill stops driver's license suspension when the only violation is failure to pay traffic tickets. Yeah. It eliminates the additional suspension period after paying a ticket, after driving, after suspension, so that when you pay your fine, you're not then resuspended. It maintains the current process within law that has collections as a route to collect unpaid fines and fees. And it doesn't impact in any way the suspensions for driving conduct involving DUIs, reckless drivers, reckless driving, or habitual offenders. So why are we interested in looking at unpaid traffic tickets and driver's license suspensions? The suspending a driver's license for an unpaid traffic ticket has no bearing and does not impact public safety. It prevents people from legally driving to get to work, to earn their paycheck, to pay their existing fines. A Rutgers study showed that 42% of people whose licenses were suspended because of fines and fees subsequently lost their jobs. And I'll give you one guess what happened when they lost their job. They didn't pay their fines and fees. And so we want to make it sure that people are able to continue to get to work. It imposes a significant burden on law enforcement and the courts and takes away time from serious issues dealing with traffic and driving conduct. Some people continue to drive on a suspended license in order to keep their job. We're really creating a catch-22 where you need to work to pay off your ticket, but then because of your inability to come up with the extra money, you're not able to drive. This cycle becomes a burden, and one of the things it does is we're, in some instances, criminalizing poverty, which I think is not called for. And so I think this job or this bill goes away to addressing that. And then the other factor here is that if someone does drive after suspension, when they get their license suspended because of an unpaid violation, insurance companies treat DAS the same as they would for a driving under the influence ticket, and it has an immediate and significant impact on insurance rates. And so we're making it even more costly and difficult for that driver to remain insured as well. And so we have processes right now within current law to collect fines and fees on those that don't pay. It goes to collections. It can be recovered from the State Department of Revenue, from a tax refund, a state tax refund, and it can be collected through the collections process. So we're getting our money. I think we ought not punish people in the process by stopping them from being able to get to work. With that, Madam Chair, I think there are three testifiers to the bill.
All right, Representative, as Ms. Siegel and Ms. Borner are coming up, then and Ms. Jackson, Representative Hertaus has a question. So
I can wait for the testifier.
Okay, very good. All right, welcome, and please give us your name and who you represent, please.
Madam Chair, thank you, and Representative Zerwas, thank you so much for authoring this bill. My name is Susan Siegel, and I'm the city attorney for the city of Minneapolis. My office handles about 16,000 criminal cases a year, high volume, lower level misdemeanors, and gross misdemeanors. And Representative Zerwas's bill just makes so much common sense. As a prosecutor, we need to prioritize matters that involve public safety. Well, suspending somebody's license just because they don't have the ability to pay does not serve that end. And I will tell you that we are very aggressive when it comes to bad driving, reckless driving. Just a couple years ago, in 2015, the city of Minneapolis lobbied for, and this legislature enacted a new gross misdemeanor offense for reckless driving. Last year alone, we obtained three gross misdemeanor convictions for reckless, careless driving where three pedestrians died in the city of Minneapolis. Those are three people who should have been alive today because people were not looking ahead of them where they were driving. So we are very aggressive. DWI cases, we have close to 100% conviction rate, and we prosecute over 600 of those cases a year. So we are not soft and fuzzy in our office, but we are smart and try to be fair and try to avoid collateral harm. And this whole system of fines and fees and then suspension of a driver's license, as Representative Zerwas says, really catches people in a catch-22. And I would say to some extent it makes people less safe because there are people who, because they need to hold down a job, because they need to get their kids from point A and point B, who may be working lower-wage jobs, maybe working a couple of lower-wage jobs, because it is difficult to get down to the courthouse. And this is not just an I imagine it's much more difficult. In the city of Minneapolis, even with public transit, et cetera, in the amount of time you have to take to get downtown, spend several afternoons downtown. And I think the result of the current system is that you've got people driving without licenses, and worse for all of us who have automobile insurance is you have people who then are driving uninsured, and that creates a burden and increased costs for all of us. The revenue department, I believe, does most of the collections for unpaid tickets, and they have a lot of tools at their disposal, and they're pretty effective at it. So I don't think there will be suddenly a big drop in revenue as a result. But this is just a smart solution that just makes a lot of sense for people in our state.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. And next up is?
Good afternoon. Jeanette Berner. I am the First Assistant Public Defender in Hennepin County, and I'm representing public defenders throughout the state on this issue. I think to take a picture, it's a rare event when you see the city attorney and the public defender joining at the hip on promoting something that some people would say is a public safety issue. It's not. I'm here to tell you that this is absolutely an economic issue. It's an issue where people do not have adequate ability to get transportation, and they cannot work, and it's a vicious cycle that in my now 27 years, I've seen people suck in. I have honestly spent my career struggling with this issue with my clients. I think you have an example in your packet of a client who goes through the system starting with a speeding ticket and ending up actually in jail for not paying a fee and being in a cycle of never being able to get a license. Our calendars are filled every day with clients like that individual. I'm going to cut out some of this information because I think it's going to get redundant. I want to respect your time. I would highlight that we're not here to say that people who commit dangerous driving shouldn't lose their licenses. I mean, I'll always argue against that as a public defender, but I mean, it makes common sense that we should differentiate. What we have here is a court of where the courts are struggling with people who just have traffic debt. I mean, it's really how you have to look at it. It's simply traffic debt. A basic ticket with all its fines, fees, and charges for an indigent person is $130. Most PD clients, public defender clients, live on less than that per week. Many jobs, as you've heard, for individuals are related to having transportation. And I think we're privileged in the inner city in the sense that we do have a transportation system. But in the current market, a lot of jobs that are available to my clients who don't need any special skill, maybe they don't have the education needed, are construction-related jobs that are outside of the immediate metro area. And I can tell you from personal experience, my son, when he was 18, one of his first summer jobs was a plumber's assistant on a construction site. And the predominant question and focus of the employer was, do you have a license? It wasn't, what are your references? It wasn't, what's your experience? It's, do you have a license? And that really hit hard for us because we realized that that was really, that's what employers care about. They want people to come and work, and they need to know that people can drive there. I think that this vicious cycle that we're in is, it needs to stop. It's been many years in the making. I would say to you that the expense involved, just from a budget perspective, of the energy that the city attorney's office, and I will agree with Ms. Siegel that they are not soft on crime. I'm a witness to the fact that they are not soft on crime, is that the arraignment calendars that we handle are flooded with these cases. We have to dedicate public defender, judicial, and city attorney resources, not to mention probation resources, in handling these drivers after driving after suspension cases. And I'm not suggesting that I don't want business. I want to have a job. But I think we'd all agree that we should be focusing on more serious cases. I think that I would submit to you that licensed drivers are statistically safer. They're less inclined to be evasive. I think that they obtain insurance, and that's safer. It's safer for all of us if people have insurance. I'm really proud that multiple stakeholders from across lines of business are supporting this. I truly am, because, like I said, it's been a career in the making for me to push this forward. I think you all should be aware that there are many other states that are ahead of us on this. Washington stopped suspending driver's license for unpaid tickets in 2012. California last June. The state of Mississippi stopped suspending driver's license for unpaid tickets in December and immediately reinstated all licenses suspended for unpaid court debt. And currently in the state of Tennessee, some citizens have filed an injunction against the state to stop this procedure, and that case has significant traction. So there's a lot of litigation happening around the nation, and I believe in Minnesota that we are progressive-minded about where the future of driver's license suspensions are. I will leave you with this story. 5 years ago, I was sitting in a model drug court. I don't know if you all know what that is, but we have a model drug court in Hennepin County where people who have addiction issues and criminal charges are in that court. There's a graduation that's held every year where the presiding judge presides over that graduation. One of the drug court graduates came forward, and they usually give a little testimonial about their experience, and he began to talk about the fact that he'd been addicted to cocaine for many, many years, and he'd been sober for the last three, and he was proud. And then he said, but what I'm actually most proud of here today is that I, after 7 years, have a driver's license through the work of my public defender and the city attorney, and called out the city attorney's office specifically. He was more proud to have a driver's license than he was to attain sobriety. So I'm urging you to pass this bill.
So we do have a number of questions from the committee, but why don't we go ahead and hear from, is that Ms. Jackson? Okay. Welcome, Ms. Jackson. Please give us your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Leah Jackson. I grew up in Otsego, Minnesota, and I now live in Minneapolis. I work as a restaurant server and a dance instructor through St. Paul Parks and Recreation. Thank you for the chance for me to tell you about how driving suspensions has caused me significant impact both financially and occupationally. In October of 2014, I was taking a left turn at a green light yield and pulled out into the intersection like I was taught in driving school. I was waiting for a break in traffic, giving me proper time to make the turn. As the light was turning yellow, the last car sped up, causing me to have to wait longer, and I was not able to complete the turn until the light turned red. I was pulled over immediately and told that pulling out into the intersection was illegal. I was given a ticket for obstructing traffic and intersection gridlock, which cost $135. I was 20 years old at the time and had just gotten a new job as a store manager of a retail store, and had just moved into a new house. I was out of town at my initial job training and was driving back to the hotel when I got the ticket. I hadn't gotten my first paycheck yet, as is just the first few days on the job. I had to make sure I could save enough money for food and rent, so I didn't have the money to pay for the ticket right away. I actually wasn't sure how long I had to pay the ticket, and thought that I would get to it after a few paychecks and knew I could cover the basics. And then I ended up moving again a couple months later into my own apartment, which delayed me being able to pay for this ticket even longer. The following February, I was pulled over, told my license was suspended, given a driving after suspension ticket that cost $200, plus all the fees and surcharges, even though I was never notified of the suspension. Though I had just moved, my mailing address and the address on my driver's license was still my parents' house, so it should have gone there, but I never received anything. And I had no idea I was suspended until I got pulled over and got that ticket. Right now, I had $500 in fines and knew I wouldn't be able to pay it until I received my tax refund. But part of my responsibility for work was to make deliveries and bank runs for the retail store I worked at, so I kept driving so I could keep my job because my boss was not happy about the situation. Within about 2 weeks, I received two more driving after suspension tickets, one while making a bank run for work and one for driving to my second job, which is being a dance teacher. After that, I started asking friends and my employees to come pick me up during my shift to drive me to the bank and to dance classes so I wouldn't get any more tickets. On days when they couldn't, I really wasn't able to fulfill my duties as a store manager. And I was so stressed. Not only was I in trouble at work, I also had to miss family dinners and events and couldn't save money to pay off my debt. When my tax refund finally came, I went downtown to the government center and was able to speak with a hearing officer who reduced my fines from about $900 to $625. I paid it off and was able to get my license back, but my problems were not over. Because of the driving after suspension tickets, my auto insurance company eventually dropped me as a client, and I wasn't able to find new insurance for less than $1,000 a month if they would even accept me. Luckily, I was connected to a broker through a restaurant customer, and he was able to find me insurance for $650 a month. It's been 3.5 years, and I still pay $135 a month for insurance, which is way higher than ever before. If you add up the total cost of the tickets, including the increase in auto insurance I've been paying for the 3.5 years, the total is $13,400. If my license hadn't been suspended, I would have been able to continue driving for work. I would have been able to keep my car insurance at the much lower rate, and I would have been able to save money from that tax return and from work throughout the years. I know it's important for people to drive safely, but it doesn't seem right for one traffic ticket to add up to over $13,000 in costs. I hope the legislature will figure out a way to stop suspending driver's license for people who might not be able to pay the whole cost of the ticket right away. Because of that $13,000, I wouldn't have had to live paycheck to paycheck. I wouldn't have been pushed further into debt, kept from pursuing further education, and I would have been able to live a more comfortable life. Thank you.
Ms. Jackson, I really appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
We have, what, Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Zerwas. This is a good bill. Thank you for bringing it forward. It's something that has been on my agenda. I just haven't gotten around to actually dealing with it. Members, I want to share with you as an employer the practicality of why this bill is really so important. I've had a number of circumstances over the years where you have people working for you that are driving your trucks and equipment, going out to job sites. And what we find is if they can't drive, I have no use for them as an employee. And what happens too often is oftentimes employees don't tell their employer that they have a suspended license. And unfortunately, in the trades, we find more and more that the insurance companies dictate to us who we can hire. And we heard some of the testimony, and I'm really sorry for the collateral consequences that come with these situations and where you're not inimical to public safety. You know, you're not a DWI, you're not driving recklessly, but you have a equipment violation or have some other circumstance in which you're pulled over and you don't have the money to pay the fine. And the collateral consequences that haven't even been talked about is that, you know, we've got some attorneys here talking about it, but then we get into the law's snare with the viciousness of not paying fines on time, and then you have more problems with the tort system. Then you get eventually to the actual revocation and suspension, and then it costs you another $300, which I've fronted money for some of my employees to get their license back so they can drive. But it just keeps going down a rabbit hole that makes it very difficult for people that find themselves in harm's way of not having the money or the resources to deal with some of these things, to really go down a rabbit hole in which it's very difficult for them to rise up out of a situation like this. So this is a common.
Was there a question?
Well, the common sense thing is I think that we can also know that the state will get its money. You've got tax returns. You've got all sorts of different issues in which you can do that, and just a common sense thing. And lastly, just as a comment also, we do this to people with professional licenses. If you can't pay your taxes, we revoke their licenses. What a dumb thing to do. I mean, if you can't go to work, how are you going to pay your bills? So we really need to not be so punitive for people that are trying to get ahead. We should be helping lift people up. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the public defender or Ms. Siegel driving regarding the offenses. As a matter of fact, speaking of offenses, these fines I've always found offensive personally. $135 when you go through a red light or accidentally, that's an offense. So was some of the other fines. But anyway, we'll deal with that later. Question for public defender and or the author. Will this bill, when it's enacted, and I don't see a date, should it become law or when it becomes law, let's just say July 1st of 2018, will it be retroactive to those folks that are in the same predicament of this testifier, stuck in such a system that it's failing them? So is it retroactive and then forgiving of those fines of suspended license from perhaps this year or the past, or are those folks just unfortunately stuck in that same old vicious cycle, circle that you have passed out here that many find themselves in?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, Representative McDonald, in the current form, we do not have a look-back procedure. As you heard from one of the testifiers, one of the states that addressed this problem did go back and unsuspend licenses. I'm not going to insert a comment about if Minlars can do that. but it's not something that is currently included. But Representative McDonald, I would be absolutely open to working with you and other members that might be interested in that for potential amendments as we move forward.
And Representative McDonald, there's still a few days left to get bills drafted. I don't really want to encourage that, but whatever. Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first want to just say thank you to Ms. Jackson for sharing her story, echoing Representative Hurtaugh's statements too. But question for Ms. Berner, right? I'm sorry. I know you mentioned some of the fines, and if I can remember right, remind me what it is to cost to reinstate your license after revocation.
Ms. Berner.
Sorry, it depends what the revocation is for. So,
do you want to maybe be in the microphone there? That would be great.
This is actually more information that our Mary Ellen Hang, the deputy city attorney, would know the detail of, but for like a driver's license, DWI, $700 or something like that. I believe for driving after suspension, the first one to reinstate after you pay the fines is 30, is it? 20 or 30, and then each time it's more money, I believe. It isn't something that I'm intricately a part of, you know, getting the license reinstated and the payments of it, so I don't want to speak out of turn.
Okay. Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think if I remember right, too, in our statutes, it requires you to pay cash. So it makes it. These fines are really tough for some people to pay when they start piling up like that.
Okay. Representative Bar-R. Bar-C. I'm sorry. Bar-C.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be first, Representative Zerwas, thank you. This is a good bill. And the question's for the city attorney, I guess. Could you give me kind of an example where the cutoff line is between, obviously, if you get a DUI, we're probably not going to let you keep your license. And if you run a red light or improper turn or 5 or 10 over the limit or some kind of speeding ticket, this would apply. So you kind of give me a cutoff between, where this would stop and become
So where aren't we suspending the license, you mean, more or less? Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, Ms. Siegel.
Madam Chair and Representative, this would just prevent suspension for non-payment of fines. So you would still get points for moving violations, and your license could still be suspended for moving violations. That is public safety related. And this would just prohibit suspension solely for nonpayment of fines.
And Representative Ross?
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I think it's important to also identify that as a backstop to all this, the habitual offender piece remains in place, and so that if you get, is it four or five, within a certain time period, your license will still be suspended because of that, again, driving conduct. And so this is in no way opening the door saying drive like a maniac, we're never going to take your driver's license away. If you continue to violate the law at a certain point because of that driving conduct, we will do the suspension. We're just not going to criminalize an inability to pay.
Representative Mason.
Probably just going to just duplicating some of the comments, but I was just talking with somebody the other day about the ways that we make it impossible for people to keep jobs, and taking away their licenses is, to me, just as somebody has already said, it makes no sense. So I do appreciate this. There's probably a few other things we could look at, because she had, I think Ms. Jackson had mentioned the insurance company. And I think that the insurance companies probably do more damage than actually going through the courts in some cases. And that one just boggles my mind to no end. And that's, yeah.
Right. Yep. Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Zerwas. For the record, fortunately for this bill, Menlars has not taken over driver's licenses yet. So.
There you go. Good to clarify. all right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either for or against the bill? Okay. Very good. Thanks very much for the testimony, and I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3356 to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. And we get to keep the same author and some of the same testifiers, perhaps.
All right.
Okay. So we're on to House File 3357, or?
Oh, no. Draft loves the bill, too.
I don't know if we've seen this before, but you can listen in, Representative Draskowski.
Would you like to do my other bill, Madam Chair?
Well, let's see.
Are you on your draft? I don't.
We have.
Just that, 3357.
Okay. So 3357, and maybe this is quick because we've kind of heard the issues. So why don't you go ahead then, and I'll. Just a second here. I'll move the bill. It's going to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. So go ahead, Representative Ross.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 3357 is similar. What it does is it gives the courts the discretion to reduce or waive the $75 state surcharge, which comes with a moving violation. Right now, a judge, with their discretion, can waive or reduce court fines for a moving violation, but by statute can't adjust the $75 surcharge. This will require a judge to consider the ability to pay before setting the amount of the fine and whether or not to waive or reduce the surcharge. And it adds language to the standard citation form notifying people of their right to ask for a reduction of the cost of their ticket based on the ability to pay. The $75 surcharge drives the cost of a basic ticket at about $50 or $55 up to about $130 for an individual that can prove that they're in poverty or indigent. That that becomes an enormous addition to their moving violation. Oftentimes what we see is a judge will reduce that fine, but by state statute are not allowed to adjust the $75 fee. 45% default rate on the surcharge currently. That's how big of a deal this is. This really impacts individuals that are unable to pay that amount. And I think one of the things we look at is we look at how in traffic court across the state this is implemented. We need to have fair and uniform consideration under the law. In some jurisdictions, generally in the metro area, there are judges that are currently looking at an individual's ability to pay and then looking at that fine amount and reducing that fine amount. In many other jurisdictions across the state, an ability to pay doesn't even enter into the equation, and the set fine is just moved forward, and so we don't have equal treatment across the state. To be really clear, the state surcharge of $75 was very directly and very openly increased to fill a budget shortfall. And the legislature was very clear that they were going to balance their books of increasing the shortfall or increasing the surcharge. That was what behind the significant increase in the surcharge. We're at a position now where I'm not saying we reduce it for everybody, but we allow judges the ability, if they meet the statutory threshold of indigency, that we allow the judges the discretion to the option to reduce the surcharge at that point. And that, in gist, is what the bill does. Madam Chair, we do have a few testifiers. I know there was a testifier that came from Duluth to testify on this bill, so out of respect for that individual's time, I'd like to make sure that they get to testify. But I'll hand it over to you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative, we have Susie Green from Community Action Duluth. Shall we have her come up then and testify? Present. Welcome, Ms. Green, and please give us your name and who you represent, please, for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susie Green. I'm a transportation coach with Community Action Duluth, and thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of the House File 3357. My job at Community Action Duluth involves working with people who struggle with transportation issues, helping them access transportation they need to get to work, pick up their kids, just manage everyday life. The bulk of my participants have suspended or revoked driver's license, can't afford to pay the cost required to get their driver's license back. The ironic thing is that not having the driver's license, it's hard for them to get back and forth to work, to be able to save money, which then becomes a struggle to get the fines and fees paid. So it's like it's a perpetual circle. No good. For example, I work with a mom with a five-year-old daughter whose license has been suspended for an unpaid ticket in another county. She's working right now with me on her budget, her balance. We're looking to get her ticket paid off. But currently she's taking the bus. She's living paycheck to paycheck. She's trying to save for this, for rent, child care, and just other transportation needs due to the fact that she can't drive. This bill asks judges to consider someone's ability to pay before imposing a fine on them, and it would allow judges at their discretion to decide what the amount would be for appropriate to give to somebody. Most traffic tickets cost about $140, and some are even more than that. For driving after suspension or revocation, it's about $300, and then you tack on the $75, so that's almost $100 more. I work with people every day, day in and out, who cannot afford to pay these tickets and can't afford to even save up for the tickets. The most people that I work with have more than one ticket because they keep driving in order to get to work or just deal with everyday life. And then insurance costs are going way up after driving after revocation ticket or driving after suspension. So when I go to court with some of my clients, most judges will consider the ability to pay if we ask them to. I tend to go be an advocate, letting the judges know that where these people stand, giving them the surcharge is not going to help anything. And even if the judge wants to make it possible for my clients to drive legally, they're not able to reduce the $75 surcharge. So they end up reducing the fines. Some people have several tickets, with the $75 surcharge on top of each one, which doesn't fit in their budget at all. If judges considered someone's ability to pay and set fines that were possible for them to pay, they could get back to work sooner, meet the responsibilities of their families. So in conclusion, setting a fine that's impossible for someone to pay doesn't make our roads safer. It just guarantees that someone will lose their license and face increasing challenges in order to get out of debt for court. It will also drive their insurance costs up, as we've heard. We need to make sure that judges everywhere are considering ability to pay, even for people who don't have an advocate to tell them that's their right. And then when judges set fines at the right level for someone's income, they can pay off their debt and get their license back and get their life back on track. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Green. And was there anyone else then that wanted to testify?
Madam,
I think
Chair,
we understand the bill.
I think we have two testifiers that would be the same two from the previous bill that could be available for
sure.
Questions.
Very good. Any questions from the committee?
Yeah.
Okay. What was that? Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zerwas, do we know how much money is generated on surcharges and whether or not our MMB is budgeting fines into our general revenue?
Representative Hertas.
Madam Chair, members, that's information that I do not have at this point. But when we get to the Public Safety and Finance Committee, because that would be out of their budget, that's something that we'll have if this is heard in public safety.
Very good.
Follow up, Representative
yeah. Hertas.
Well, thank you for that. And I would submit that it's hard to know how many fines are going to be issued in a year and that it shouldn't be as part of the budget, that it's kind of like funny money that's floating out there. And Representative Zerwas, I would be in favor of your considering amending the bill to give, and I trust judges, to have greater latitude to waive that whatever they think is appropriate, not just based on income, but there might be other mitigating circumstances. I think we should be getting back to imposing the fine that's on the books and not continue to collect these surcharges, as you've pointed out. Thank you.
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. I noticed in the underlying statutes in 2016, we already lowered the surcharge for those who qualify for a public defender, but we only lowered it to 50, which can still be a lot. My question for you, though, too, you mentioned that we added the surcharge in to help balance the budget. Looking at the underlying statute, that was in 2016, right?
Representative Zerwas?
No, it was, Madam Chair, I think the increase in the statute was part.
Yeah, it would be prior to it's under a prior administration, not Governor Dayton's administration when we first started seeing criminal surcharges.
Thank you. Okay. Representative McDonald.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I heard a number meeting with some of the good folks regarding your bill, which I did sign on yesterday. $33 million is the number that was given to me with the surcharge only given. And just quickly, I would echo Representative Hertas's regarding giving the judge the opportunity to waive or lower that fee for all folks, not just those under undue hardships. Who's undue hardships? That's a lot of money. That's a whole groceries for my family. It's a lot of money. I mean, it's not a lot of money, but it is a lot of money for folks, not just if you're in a certain income level. But that's a good chunk of change, and it's clearly we don't need it anymore because we have a surplus going into the next biennium as well. So I have an oral amendment to repeal that $75 surcharge if you'll be so friendly to accept it.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, if you could, if Representative McDonald can convince Chair Brian Johnson to take that $33 million out of his budget, I would love that. But I think you and I are going to probably have to talk to him about that.
Okay. All right. I think we've exhausted the questions. Is there anyone else then who wishes to testify on the bill? Okay. Seeing none, I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3357 to the Public Safety Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I follow
you, Representative.
And you should be contributing too.
Representative Veskowski. House File 3546, please.
Yeah.
Welcome, Representative Baskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, is a page here to help us set up equipment?
We're looking for the page for what equipment did you say?
Yes.
Representative?
Yes.
So we're talking about a PowerPoint.
We've got a couple video, couple short videos.
Okay. Well.
While we're waiting for him, Madam Chair, I could introduce the bill.
Okay, we're looking for Matthias the page. Okay, great. So.
Madam Chair and members, while Matthias is helping
us. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you.
The bill is going to go to Transportation Finance, so I'll move your bill. House File 3546, and it'll go to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 2536 is a bill dealing with school bus safety. I actually have with me here today Russ Meyer, who is from Tileman, Minnesota, which probably most of us haven't been to. I've been to. It's in my house district. And he brought up to me last summer, I think it was, a concern that he had because he operates a trucking company and is very interested in safety and has been really bothered by many of the close calls and sometimes not so close calls with school buses and kids. And so we held a series of meetings, probably six or so, over the interim with the School Board Association, the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. You'll hear Lieutenant Brian Rue here soon, too. And we crafted a bill dealing with school bus safety. And, Madam Chair and members, as we looked at this issue and tried to make school buses safer, one of the things that, first of all, we look back and last session, we passed a bill that actually increased the fine for people who drive by school buses when their lights are on, and that's in law now. The question was, what are the best approaches? And you know, there's a lot of prevailing discussion out there about adding cameras to school buses and doing other things. And, you know, I think part of the discussion said that, you know, okay, you add a camera to a school bus, and the kid's already dead because they've been run over by that time. Instead of that, let's have something that reduces the number of drive-bys where people are driving by the school buses when their flashing red lights are on and actually decrease the interactions. And so we looked at that, and the discussion was around, well, why are people driving by school buses to begin with? Do they just, you know, don't care about the law and they're aware what the law is and they drive by it anyway, or are they not aware and they're distracted? And it seemed that the prevailing notion was that there's some of each. And so our goal with this is to increase the light intensity of school buses, to have some of the LED type of technologies and messaging capabilities that we've seen in other states, and you'll see hopefully some of those examples in the discussion here today, and distract the people who are distracted from being distracted before they come in contact with the school bus. So we want to distract the distracted with lighting and make school buses safer and make our kids safer as they're delivered to and from school. So that's my introduction, Madam Chair, and I think Mr. Meyer is here to introduce himself in the video.
Very good. Mr. Meyer, do you want to just say a few words then?
Yes, Madam Chair. My family started in the transportation business in 1925.
And please give us your name and who you represent.
I'm Russ Meyer. I'm the CEO of California Overland out of Wabasha, Minnesota.
Very good.
And,
please proceed.
My fleet runs about 1 million miles a year in Minnesota and around the country, the whole United States. I was fortunate enough to have buses in the 70s. I had bought a small fleet from my grandfather when I graduated from high school, and What I see is the lights that are on the buses nowadays are very similar to the ones that were back in the 70s. And it's been a lot of, you know, with the advent of LED strobes, it's been a lot of refinements on lights so that people can see them. And, you know, in getting into this, you know, you park a bus with 54 or 60 kids in the middle of a highway, And we're all assuming that somebody can see it. And sometimes, like Steve said, they're distracted. It's a very dangerous situation. Now, if you had an ambulance in the middle of the highway, chances are you're going to see it, or a highway patrol, you're going to see it from a half a mile away and start kind of getting ready for something is up front here. But a bus, if it's foggy, if it's a snowy day, if it's whatever, if things aren't perfect, you might not see it. And I've told Steve and I've told the group that I work with, I worry that someday it could be one of my trucks. So I'm an advocate of lights. There is an expense to it, but these new strobing LEDs and lights that are available make a bus much more readily, you know, seeable or whatever you want to call it. Now, when a person does pass a bus with the stop sign out and the red lights on, a lot of times they're not doing it on purpose, and I think a judge a lot of times has sympathy for the person and might let them off for, you know, I think it's like, don't quote me, but probably 90,000 times a day in America, people go through that red stop sign when the bus is sitting. It's very dangerous. And to be honest with you today, if we discuss this and make some good changes and we save one life, it was well worth all the time for me, because it's a very serious situation. Another thing is, in the fog, sometimes I've talked to my drivers too, white reflective tape is readily, you can see it, even before lights. Don't ask me why, but I'm just here to see what we can do on a state level in Minnesota. I'd like to lead the nation here to try to get these things so we can see them better. And hopefully the people that do care and do want to, you know, stop and abide by the law have a better chance or opportunity of doing that. And the careless ones, you see them all the time. I mean, I have some videos here, and I don't want to bore everybody, but I can show you some of the things that I'm talking about. And I have them on my iPad, so it's not really the best device, but they're going to try and make it work. But it's pretty simple, and there is a cost associated too. It's not a free deal to light these things up. Right there. This one happened in Minnesota, I think, on Highway 12.
A semi driver overtook the bus at highway speed from the right shoulder. What makes this even scarier is the fact that Alexis Schwartz was about to go from her driveway to the bus. So the semi-truck went through the path between Alexis and the school bus. Alexis had this to say.
The dust kicked up on me, and then I had to step back because that just freaked me out and made my heart go crazy.
The Minnesota State Patrol posted the video online in hopes that the public will help catch the truck driver. The incident occurred this past Friday. In a later update, they noted the driver of the semi that illegally passed a school bus and was caught on video turned himself in Tuesday night. Thank you to everyone who shared this video and helped spread the word.
This guy, when he was caught, Lieutenant Rue knows more about it, but he went to prison for it. That company that passed that bus, my brother-in-law owned it. And he was devastated because that happened, and it was one of his drivers. He ended up selling his company as a smaller one to me. And, to this day we talk about it. He just said, what if he wouldn't have cleared the... Now, you have to realize he cleared the bus between the bus and the passenger that was going to enter the bus and the mailboxes. It was just like an impossible thing for him to do. So that's one of the reasons I'm here, because I pictured that, and I'm like, how devastating is that whole accident? Now, Lieutenant Rule was to, I think was out in Ohio, and he was able to visualize this bus. This bus here is it up there?
Yep.
They have this on display out there, which is just one of the things that you can do to make it so people can see it. With that, I'll let our great lieutenant talk.
We need sunglasses? It's going to be pretty bright.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Brian Rue, Minnesota State Patrol, specifically with the Office of People Transportation. We appreciate the passion that Mr. Meyer has brought to trying to increase student safety in Minnesota, and also want to thank Representative Joskowski for including us in the discussions on drafting the bill. There have been different versions of it, and we appreciate him working with us to listen to our comments and to get it into a position that we like. As the videos you just shown just show us some different options, and in the language of the bill, it provides us with the direction that we as the department with the industry stakeholders will establish kind of the standard of what we want to see in Minnesota. So working with the industry, we can do that. Section 1 of the bill references, or Article 1, Section 2 references a potential electronic messaging. And then Article 3, Section 3 also addresses the electronic message board to be on the back of the door versus the black standard lettering that you see. This is just one example of what those lights might look like. You could do a pre-warning caution light, and then it would switch to the red sign. Just again, the intent of all this is just to try to increase the visibility, to get people to notice that the bus is stopping, and so they will stop and allow those students to safely board or get off the bus. And if you have any questions for me, Mr. Chair, or members, I'm certainly willing to answer anything.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. I don't think we have any member questions yet. To the author, I believe we're looking at this. It should have a stop at Education Finance.
Wherever you and your staff think it needs to go, Mr. Chair.
Well, we're thinking at Finance. My question would be, this is a requirement out of their levy. Is that correct?
Correct.
If you could explain that to members, even though it's a policy committee.
So, members, what we do is we take the long-term facilities money that was enacted into law last year and will be enacted over a series of years for those areas, and we actually earmark encumber a piece of that for this purpose. And we also include in the safe schools area, we enable that to be used for this at the discretion of the school district if they'd rather use that money. So those are the two things, and they are education finance related. Mr. Chair, I don't know if the Education Policy Committee needs to see this or not. Probably not, but education finance would probably, that makes sense.
At least them. Representative Draskowski, have you talked to local school districts in your area or other areas? I'm curious what their opinion of that is.
Yes, we have. I've actually talked to two bus companies that drive for two different bus companies in my district. We also included Ms. Kelleher's here from the School Boards Association, and she was part of our work group that developed this bill, along with Mr. Kelleher from the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, and he told me this morning that we can say that they fully support the bill. So we've had those inputs from them, and I don't know if Ms. Keller wants to talk or not about the bill.
And Representative Joachim, did you have a question? I'm not sure if you're on the list, if there's a line through it, but But you can wait. I'll go to you after the testimony.
I
or
can wait after.
If that's okay. Testimony. Perfect. Ms. Kelleher, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and add your testimony.
Good afternoon, members and Mr. Chairman. Grace Kelleher with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every school district in the state of Minnesota. And let me be clear, this is highly unusual. Never did I dream I'd sit next to Representative Drazkowski on an education bill. And never did you think you'd hear me going, well, maybe a mandate isn't so bad. So disregard, knowing how far we're both pushing ourselves to be here for kids, I do want to talk about it's a mandate. You'll find it on 1.20 that basically says all buses manufactured after August 1st, 2021 would have this technology in them. So we're going to be buying new buses. And we've used that in the past when we've changed standards going forward. The next one is on 4.12. This said we must have our facility plans must also include a provision for safe and visibility of school district-owned buses. And then I think that another one on 6.17. There where it says we must put reserve at least $2, but not more than $5. For supplemental warning systems until all our buses catch up. And, Mr. Chairman, MSBA is not for mandates, but keeping kids safe, whether it's from an incident going on in the school district or outside, our children ride to school every day on these school buses. Sometimes we get lost in all of the other noise. But I don't know how you felt after looking at the light demonstration, but to me, the difference is amazing. So when you leave today, keep your eyes open for an older school bus that doesn't have those lights on, and you'll not start to notice how dim it is. So I want you to know with begrudging but sincere, I think this is one of those mandates that might be difficult I want to say man up, but that's probably sexist. muscle up to do. I think it's a worthy one, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Great. Thank you for sharing your testimony. Any member questions? Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Kelleher, just one quick question, and I was a little concerned about this, too. We seem to be putting forward a lot of bills to chip away at that safe school levy. And I know a lot of school districts are already trying to supplement that just to keep up with all their needs. So are you concerned about that as well as having this an option to take just one more thing out of this $36 multiplier?
You are right on the money, literally. Both the long-term facility maintenance and the safe school, most of it is used in different products. Fortunately, we are looking at expanding safe schools and long-term maintenance here in the House as well as in the Senate. It's a tough call, and those dollars are used for school resource officers and all other safety needs going forward. So the answer is yes, school district uses already, and this would really tell them, as I said, how they have to use this money going forward. The question becomes then, what added benefit would districts receive from this?
Okay. Representative Bernardi?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Drazkowski, this is kind of an interesting day to have you have this unfunded mandate brought before us. I don't know if you see it that way or not.
Representative Drazkowski?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, I've never written a bill before that had a mandate in it, but this one's funded.
Okay, so this is my question for you. Would you, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Drazkowski, some of these levies that are being proposed here are already maxed out by, like, almost all the school districts except for, like, four. I heard about this morning, and I was checking with Ms. Kelleher about the other one, and they're pretty maxed out as well. So this is my question for you. Would you consider making this a state aid rather than making people put it on their property taxes?
I'll have you answer that. Okay. I guess now we're kind of getting a little bit more in the finance question, so we can maybe bring that up. But if you want to address that, Representative Drazkowski, go ahead. But members, we'll try to. I brought up the question myself, you know, a little concerned about it, but I don't want to get too deep into it, and we've got some other member questions, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bernardi, all of the schools in Minnesota can use that long-term facilities levy money for this. It's up to them how they're going to spend that money. It's not maxed out. They can set priorities within there, and we ask them to set one of the priorities be for the school bus safety measure. So they have the ability with the money that's already been allocated from them from the state and is being matched by property taxes without increasing property taxes or state money to those schools.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, just a follow-up.
I
think this is a finance issue for the education department, but my school district just met with me today, and I don't know that that's accurate for my school district, that they have room to do more money in this. So I just want to make sure that all school districts actually have access to the dollars needed to make this happen. So I think that's important to clarify how this impacts different school districts across the state. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative McDonald.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was texting my good friend Jay Burnick from Stolke Bus out in Delano. He and his wife Rainey own the business, and he was just curious about that sign that the officer put out that he displayed, and I sent him the picture. He's wondering if that is on the front of the bus or the bumper.
Rear door.
Mr. Chair.
Rear door.
And Representative McDonald, yeah, it would go on the rear door right down below or on the lowest glass pane of the door. As a matter of fact, there's language in the bill that says that right now there's prescribed language and statute that says there has to be a warning message on there, so it would allow school bus operators and school districts to have one message or the other, because there's only room for one or the other there, either the electronic version here. If that's the warning system that the department brings forward in their recommendations.
Follow.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. He thought it was very cool, another a bus owner, of course, and he says to say hi to Mr. Rue. Where's hi, Mr. Rue, Officer Rue from us.
Okay, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Drazkowski, for offering a bill for taking safety issues with our kids. My question is, you know, some of the school districts actually run their own bus service and other ones contract it out. And I know that many of the school districts that serve my district, of those eight, quite a few of them contract out, and those buses are owned by private companies or entities. How does the public money transfer on to the ownership of private equipment?
Mr. Chair.
To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hertas, we did anticipate that is in the bill, although I'm not finding it. Maybe Mr. Burris knows right where it is. But we do have in the bill. Mr. Burris will point us to it.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, this is on page 6, lines starting on 6.19. This is a provision within the long-term facilities maintenance equalization revenue statutes, and it lays out the reserve amount for school bus warning systems that a district would need to set aside, and also specifies that it kind of covers the contracted a proportional share of those dollars going to the contracted bus operators.
Mm-hmm. And if I could, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Related to that, and Representative Hertas, on lines 4.12 through 4.14, we also amend the facility plans for the school district related to buses and the busing plans, and it includes the contracted school buses in there as well.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I don't see any other questions, any other testimony? I'll make the motion to re-refer House File 3546 to Education Finance. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much for your testimony and presenting the bill. Members, we're done for